Hello and welcome to Resources Radio, a weekly podcast from Resources for the Future. I'm your host, Daniel Ramey. Today, we talk with Lisa Reynolds, a PhD candidate at the University of California at Berkeley, and an ORISE Fellow with the National Center for Environmental Economics at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Lisa is a co-author on a recent paper that estimates how hydrofluorocarbons, an industrial gas used in refrigeration and other applications, contribute to the societal costs of climate change. In today's episode, I'll ask Lisa to help us understand what are hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, how they compare with other greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane, how recent policies will reduce climate damages from HFCs, and a lot more. Stay with us. Okay, Lisa Reynolds from UC Berkeley, welcome to Resources Radio.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So Lisa, we're going to talk today about your recent work with colleagues on hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs. We're going to use that term, HFCs, a lot today. But first, I'd love to ask you how you got interested working on environmental issues. I know you're sort of a renaissance woman. You have lots of interests and skills. So what sort of helped bring you into the field of environmental policy and economics?
Sure. So I grew up in Northern California alongside my twin sister. And I think my parents' go-to solution for the absolute chaos of raising twin toddlers was to take us outside as much as physically possible. So we were all over front yard, my grandma's house in Santa Cruz, redwood trees, peninsula, foothills, just spent a lot of time running around outside growing up. And I think that's actually really where I gained a lot of my appreciation for the natural world. And then more academically, I took an AP Environmental Studies course as a senior in high school. And I think that really jump-started me thinking about studying environmental issues and thinking more critically about things like climate change. I remember doing a semester-long project where we had to collect like news articles and papers in some sub-theme of environmental studies that we found interesting. And that's actually when I started learning about environmental economics and climate change economics and got really excited about using those types of frameworks and tools, which I'd observed used in other domains to approach environmental policy. So that was sort of my start in the environmental economics, climate change economics sphere. And then I've been working on environmental issues more or less since then. First, in college, I was a major in environmental studies, focused there on ecological economics and ecosystem services. Then I worked at an environmental economics consulting firm in Boston. I actually there worked on BP oil spill evaluation and also climate change impacts work. And now throughout my PhD at UC Berkeley. So it's been since I was young, I would say.
That's really interesting. You know, we ask everybody that question when they come on the show. And I think you're the first person, at least that I've interviewed, who got into environmental economics in high school. You're like the earliest of anyone. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it was just some news article I read, but then ended up finding a really wonderful advisor in college. And they went from there.
That's really cool. So as I mentioned, Lisa, we're going to talk about your recent paper on HFCs, hydrofluorocarbons. But before we talk about the paper and the social costs of HFCs, let's just like do a little bit of background. So what are HFCs? How do they function in the economy? Like, what do they do? And why were they sort of invented in the first place?
Sure. So HFCs are a class of industrial chemicals, and they're primarily used in refrigeration, air cooling and air heating, insulating foams, and aerosol propellants. And they were developed actually as replacements for ozone-depleting substances. So those were phased out under the Montreal Protocol, which I believe went into force in 1989. And so the substances controlled by that protocol either contained chlorine or bromine, which HFCs do not contain. So they were basically a replacement for those ozone-depleting substances. The phase-out of ozone-depleting substances motivated a very rapid adoption of HFCs as a replacement, and widespread adoption of interior space conditioning and foam building insulation also contributed to that increased use. And a little bit tangentially, but relatedly, experts are now forecasting that global warming will exacerbate and accelerate the demand for cooling products around the globe. So as temperatures increase, air conditioning and other cooling technologies are going to be a very important adaptation strategy to cope with heat. And so there's a lot of literature surrounding the projections of kind of what increased adoption of these cooling technologies will mean and what those potential impacts are. An example folks might have heard of is that increased energy use for air conditioning, if fossil fuel generated, could in turn contribute to global warming and sort of create a feedback loop. Somewhat similarly, HFC emissions from those same cooling products have the potentially serious side effects for climate change. And in 2018, a report, it was called the Scientific Assessment of Ozone Depletion, reported that HFC's emissions increased by 23% over just 4 years, from 2012 to 2016. So it's really predicted that there will be escalated growth over time, especially in developing countries as adoption of these cooling technologies continues.
That's really interesting. Yeah, HFCs, I feel like there's kind of multiple layers of ironies to them, right? One is the feedback loop that you mentioned, and the other is the fact that they were invented to like solve an environmental problem, and then they've sort of created a new environmental problem.
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
And some listeners are probably aware that HFCs often have really high global warming potentials, or GWPs. So that just means on a pound-for-pound basis, they trap much more heat during their lifetimes than carbon dioxide. But can you help us understand that a little bit more, Lisa? Can you give us a sense of how HFCs are kind of currently contributing to the warming that we're experiencing today and how they might compare with other gases like carbon dioxide or methane?
Sure. Yeah, so as you said, HFCs are a very potent greenhouse gas, and they contribute to climate change and have the potential to contribute quite a bit more in coming decades. The phase-out of ODS, ozone-depleting substance, I have to say, was really important and definitely shouldn't be understated, but now we're faced with this sort of irony that you just mentioned, so now we need to kind of handle the high global warming potential of these HFCs. Quickly, there's just a few interesting characteristics of these gases that I think are worth mentioning to characterize how we think about their contribution in the future. First, they're what is referred to as short-lived greenhouse gases. So in contrast to long-lived greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, HFCs and methane remain in the atmosphere for much shorter periods of time. So they exert an impact on temperature for a much shorter time frame. But that said, while they're in the atmosphere, they have a much larger impact on temperature than a gas like carbon dioxide. So we see this when we compare what we call temperature impulse responses, which is the response of the global temperature to a pulse of a greenhouse gas emission. So the global warming potential that you mentioned takes these two elements into account over a predefined period. So for example, HFC 134A, that's the most abundant HFC in the atmosphere, has an estimated global warming potential about 1,500 times that of carbon dioxide over a 100-year period. And then one last important point here is that while carbon dioxide is emitted from activities like fossil fuel combustion that happens sort of all at once, HFCs are integral components to technologies like air conditioners, and they tend to leak out slowly over time at a much lower rate. So these different factors are relevant when we try to project their emissions and the impacts on climate change. So taking that all into account, HFCs are predicted to warm the Earth a bit less than 0.5 degrees Celsius by 2100. So to contextualize that, you know, we're trying to stay below this Paris 2 degrees Celsius target. So a bit less than 0.5 degree by 2100 is a pretty big deal. That said, there's quite a bit of variation in these predictions because it sort of depends on projections of adoption, technological shifts, policy, and more. So there's always a range. But global warming agreements like the Kigali Agreement, which I'll talk about later, are predicted to avoid much of this warming. And I think Kigali is predicted to avoid about 0.2 to 0.4 degrees Celsius. And we don't need to go into this, and we don't go into it in this paper, but I thought it might be worth mentioning also that there are really interesting active discussions about how to prioritize, how to handle sort of long-lived gases versus short-lived gases, especially in light of different policies and in light of the conversation currently around carbon dioxide and methane. So if listeners are interested, I think that's a kind of interesting space right now.
It is super interesting. And as someone who's worked on methane a little bit over the years, it is like a rich and complex and sometimes contentious conversation. But we'll save that for another day. So let's talk now about what you and your co-authors find in this paper. And just so people can find it easily, the name of the paper is The Social Costs of Hydrofluorocarbons and the Benefits from Their Expedited Phase Down. It's in Nature Climate Change. And of course, we'll have a link to it in the show notes so people can easily get to it. Listeners of this show have heard a lot about the social cost of carbon, so we don't need to go into a lot of detail about what social cost means. But really quickly, can you just remind us what we mean when we say the social costs of HFCs?
Sure. So the social cost of HFCs, or more broadly, the social cost of a greenhouse gas, measures the monetized net present value of the damages to society caused by an incremental metric ton of gas emissions. So these social costs are a key metric to informing climate policy, especially in the United States. And in particular, the estimates for carbon dioxide and methane, I would say, are the most active in the U.S. government regulatory space now. And are used by the government and other decision makers in benefit cost analysis and have been for over a decade now. And the models used to calculate these social costs draw on quite a few disciplines, including climate science, economics, demography, and several others.
Great. And the components of the social costs, vary widely, right? There's like damages that society experiences from things like sea level rise and, higher temperatures and the effects on mortality and so on, right?
That's correct. Yes. Yeah, so you can estimate these in several ways, but there are definitely several different sets of damage channels. From an economic standpoint, we often refer to two categories of them being market and non-market. But yes, there are quite a few channels, some of which are captured better than others. And there's quite a bit of ongoing work on that.
Great. And we'll just refer people to previous Resources Radio episodes on the social costs of carbon, of which there are at least two or three. Now, another final background question before we get to your results, which is just could you give us a high level overview of some of the methods you use to calculate the social costs of HFCs? And there's a ton of detail here and it's super rich. And, interested listeners should go to the paper and go to the appendices. But if you could give us a high level overview, that would be great.
Sure. So as I mentioned, the models we use to calculate these social costs integrate several disciplines, and they're called integrated assessment models, or more specifically, cost-benefit integrated assessment models. And they integrate these different disciplines together into one model and estimate the net present value of the marginal impact of emitting one ton or some pulse of a greenhouse gas into the atmosphere. And I won't bore you with all the details. Those are in the paper. But broadly, I would say there are a few steps to this calculation. So first, we estimate the model under a baseline emissions scenario. And that means we calculate the baseline damages from climate change under some assumed baseline policy scenario. And then second, we add a small marginal emissions forcing for a given HFC of interest to the model's emissions forcing projection. So we basically say, plus pulse in 2020, and then we re-estimate the model to compute damages in that sort of perturbed scenario. So to be a bit more concrete there, adding a pulse of emissions creates a marginal increase in radiative forcing, which creates a marginal increase in atmospheric and ocean temperatures. And that in turn impacts the economy along several channels like we discussed before. So we're really trying to estimate the impact of that marginal emissions on the economy. So to do so, we compute the social cost of an HFC as the net present value of the difference in damages or the marginal damages between the baseline and marginal emissions scenarios. And I'll just note quickly that this differs from using a global warming potential method. That generally focuses only on the climate science component of the process. It measures how much energy the emissions of one ton of a gas will absorb over a given period of time, and then creates a ratio relative to one ton emissions of carbon dioxide. That heuristic can be used to scale the social cost of carbon to come up with the social cost of HFCs, or for any greenhouse gas that has an estimated global warming potential, without doing this full direct calculation that we outlined here. But that method has been used quite a bit historically.
Right. Lisa, this is an extra question that I hadn't planned on asking you, but I'm wondering if you can say a little bit more about what additional benefits to policymakers does it provide to actually have a social cost estimate relative to just a global warming potential estimate? Like, why is it differently useful to have this type of figure?
Sure. So I think there are a few reasons and there are pros and cons to both approaches. But I think in this case, one of the pros is that this direct calculation approach is the way that we currently calculate social costs for other gases like carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, and methane. So using this similar methodology, I think is valuable because it helps us compare these different social costs more accurately instead of using sort of one method to calculate one set of them and a different method for the other set. More complicated, but also a very interesting literature, is that there is a kind of systematic difference between using only the climate science side or this sort of contribution to the energy balance versus including damages and economic modeling. So for example, that includes thinking about things like the discount rate, damages over time, adaptation, and just sort of a richer literature of how emissions impact social systems. And I think there's a lot of value in understanding that, and also a lot of value in literature that simply compares what the two results show and sort of decomposes why the results might be different.
Yeah, that's great. And I'll ask you in a few minutes to help us compare those results. But first, let's focus on the social costs. So what are some of the estimates that you and your co-authors come up with the social costs of HFCs? And how do they compare with other gases like CO2 and methane?
Sure. So overall, we find some very large numbers. Given what we just talked about, this is perhaps expected given the potency of these gases. But in this paper, we are able to, as I said, directly calculate the social costs under several different modeling frameworks, which I'll go into. And then we can later show what these costs generate in terms of climate benefits from proposed emissions reduction schedules, which I think is a really valuable contribution to putting kind of a dollar value on the benefits of phase downs and global agreements. So as a concrete example, the recent literature calculates the social cost of carbon dioxide to be around $190 and the social cost of methane to be around $1,600. And we find that HFC 134A, which is the most prevalent in the atmosphere, is estimated to have a social cost of $144,000 using the same model and the same near-term target discount rate. So this is dollars per ton in 2020 US dollars for a pulse of emissions in 2020. So taking the full suite of HFCs, it does vary. The model estimates social costs between about $15,000 per ton for HFC 152A to over $2 million for the most potent HFC. As I said, these are values for a ton of gas emitted in 2020. Social costs for a marginal ton emitted later tend to increase in future emissions years. So just to dive a little bit deeper, we actually present results for two different modeling frameworks. The first framework is historically used by the US government, and it harmonizes three prevalent integrated assessment models to get a single result. And then the second leverages a newer model that incorporates several significant advancements in the scientific literature and was recently used in a set of proposed updated estimates by the US EPA, or Environmental Protection Agency. So sticking with HFC 134A, the first modeling framework estimates a social cost of $96,000 per ton, while, as I said, the second estimates about $144,000 per ton. So that's a 33% increase from sort of an older modeling framework to a newer one. And I can dig into the reasons for that later if we have time. And so finally, we compare these results to estimates produced using global warming potentials from the literature. And so those, as I said, are used to scale the social cost of carbon dioxide and produce social costs of HFCs. And there's quite a bit of literature also, as I said, comparing these two, so we contribute to that. We find that the two approaches do not produce the same values and that the nature of the difference between our modeling and the global warming potential approach is fairly uniform across gases, but it's model specific. So depending on whether you're using the older modeling framework or the newer one, you're either overestimating or underestimating compared to global warming potentials.
Interesting. So the newer modeling framework tends to produce higher figures than the global warming potential, and the older modeling framework tends to produce lower figures. Is that right?
That's correct.
Interesting. So, Lisa, as you mentioned, you and your co-authors estimate the social benefits of the Kigali Amendment, which I think is sometimes called the Kigali Agreement. I'm not quite sure which term is right. Maybe you can help me sort that out. But some listeners probably know some detail about the Kigali Amendment. But for those who don't, can you give us a thumbnail sketch of what it is and then what types of benefits it would provide if it were fully implemented?
Sure. So yes, I run into this confusion as well. I believe it is formally the Kigali Amendment, but I've seen it referred to as the Kigali Agreement as well. So either works. But starting with a little bit of background on that amendment, in recognition of their potency as a greenhouse gas, the 1997 Kyoto Protocol, under the 1992 United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, included HFCs as a regulated substance. So while they were kind of included there and noted for their potency, that Kyoto Protocol includes HFCs only in their enforcement of total limits on greenhouse gas emissions, but doesn't specifically control HFC emissions. So HFC emissions are explicitly controlled under the Kigali Amendment to the Montreal Protocol, and that was came into force in 2016. So they haven't been explicitly controlled for very long. And the Kigali Agreement provides specific targets for the phase down of HFCs and is expected to avoid an increase in atmospheric temperatures of, I think, between 0.2 and 0.4 degrees Celsius by 2100. Although, as I said, those estimates are subject to lots of assumptions, so they can range. And the Kigali Amendment dictates a few different phase down schedules for different country groups, which I won't go into detail now, but broadly, these requirements range from about an 80% reduction by 2045 in the most lenient case to an 85% reduction by 2035. So these are pretty strict phase downs and admittedly already might be difficult to achieve, but there are substitutes to HFCs and more low global warming potential refrigerants that some experts think might enable an even more aggressive phase down. So considering that and the literature, we also assess the benefits under a more ambitious timeline, which we'll refer to as the maximum technologically feasible reduction schedule. So MTFR is what I'm referring to when I say that. And that entails a full phase out by 2035, so even more ambitious. So just quickly for a few numbers, we first estimate a range of total climate benefits based on the methods from the US government historically, so sort of that first modeling framework. And those range from $16 trillion total under the Kigali phase down schedule to $18 trillion under the expedited phase down schedule. So those are already some pretty big climate benefits. But if we move to the more recent modeling framework that was published in 2022, so this is one of the three models that incorporates more recent scientific literature and is used by a recent proposed EPA rule, the benefits jump quite a bit and range from $37 trillion under Kigali to $41 trillion under the expedited phase down. So under both of those frameworks, we're estimating an additional maybe 11 to 12% in climate benefits from adopting a more aggressive global phase down schedule. And overall, just some really, really high climate benefits from these agreements.
Yeah, I was just doing some searching as you were sharing those numbers. And another sort of point of context is that, you know, the entire U.S. economy in 2021 had an output of about $23 trillion. So, you know, in the ballpark of the entire U.S. economy. So those are big numbers.
Yeah, they're really big numbers. They're quite a bit bigger than certain other climate benefits we've calculated and certainly are impressive.
Yeah. So Lisa, I'm curious, before I ask you another modeling question, can you say a little bit more about the substitutes that are available for HFCs and their costs, and whether that's something that you take account for, you and your co-authors take account for in developing these estimates? Like, are we sort of like ready to go with cheap alternatives, or is there still work that needs to be done to kind of bring those costs in line with current costs of HFCs?
Sure. So that's a great question. And I have to admit, this is not my area of expertise in this paper. So I would refer you to my co-author, who worked mostly on this expedited phase down. But what I do know is that, so there are HFC substitutes, referred to as HFOs. And there are also low global warming potential refrigerants. So ammonia is one of them, and so is carbon dioxide, actually. Perhaps another irony coming full circle there. And then you can also use HFC combinations. So while you're still using HFCs, you might be able to shift simply away from the extremely high global warming potential HFCs. But I think that's a really good question about the costs and technological feasibility. And I believe in the paper we refer to the literature that we use to estimate these maximum technologically feasible solutions that would include more details there.
Great. So, yeah, for sure. Definitely another opportunity for people to look at the paper. So, Lisa, one last question I'd love to ask you before we go to our top of the stack segment, which is asking you to get into the weeds and get a little wonky and talk about the different modeling frameworks, which you've already mentioned. But I'm curious if you can say a little bit more about some of the recent advances in climate economics that are incorporated into the updated modeling framework you use, which I believe is called MIMI-GIVE. And maybe you can tell us where that name comes from. And help us understand how that change in methodology leads to these different results. And also, I'm curious if you think of whether they are like qualitatively better than previous estimates or if they're just different.
Sure. Yeah. So I'll try to hit those points. Let me know if I miss any of them. So MIMI-GIVE is referring to this second modeling framework that I've mentioned over the last parts of this podcast. And for a bit of history, which I think you might have mentioned in previous podcasts, but the National Academies of Sciences conducted a comprehensive review of social cost of carbon dioxide estimates and issued a final report in 2017 that recommended specific criteria for future updates of how to estimate the social cost of carbon dioxide, and also detailed a modeling framework that would satisfy those criteria. And this also included both near-term updates, so things that were predicted to be sort of able to be done in the near term, and then also longer term research and longer term updates pertaining to various components of the estimation process. So to break down the term, the GIVE model, so the Greenhouse Gas Impact Valuation Estimator, is the model that was recently published, I believe, in Nature in 2022 that incorporated quite a few, in fact, I think all of the near term updates listed in that report. And then MIMI-GIVE is the framework that these are built upon. So that's actually a software framework that was developed between Resources for the Future and UC Berkeley that has been meant to enable building integrated assessment models, comparing them, running uncertainty analysis, and just leveraging the skills of different researchers to bring people together to create new integrated assessment models. And we find that the results, both in terms of the social costs of individual gases and in terms of the total climate benefits of the HFC phase down, are quite a bit larger under this new modeling framework, which was somewhat expected because recent updates have shown that including all of this comprehensive evidence also shows higher social costs of carbon, higher social costs of methane. So these increased costs are a product of this new modeling framework. And in terms of different pieces, we attribute the upward shift in estimates to quite a few different components, in particular, advances in climate system representation. So a better, more accurate representation of that aforementioned temperature impulse response, or how the climate responds to an impulse of emissions. More accurate characterization of damage pathways. So there's a very rich literature on damages and impacts to the economy from changes in temperature, and those are folded into these new models. And then probabilistic socioeconomic projections, so a new approach and a new set of projecting GDP, population, and emissions into the future. And then finally, improvements to the discounting module, which adopted a growth-consistent Ramsey framework, so a different sort of approach than constant discount rates, and also just a lower near-term discount rate. So went from 3% to 2%, which is also what is suggested by a recent circular A4 from OMB. So all of these different components contribute to the increase, and I think a more quantitative breakdown is shown in that MIMI-GIVE paper.
Yeah. That's great. And that's the Rennert et al. Paper led by our colleague Kevin Rennert at RFF, who we featured on the show as well. Well, Lisa, this has been a fascinating conversation. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners have too. I'd love to ask you now to recommend something that's at the top of your literal or metaphorical reading stack. So it can be something that you've read or want to read, or something you've watched or heard. It can be related to the environment or not. We're not very picky. So what is at the top of your stack?
Sure. Yeah. So I have to admit, I listen to this podcast a lot, and I like using this question to add to my stack. I'm always very impressed with people reading different informational and academically relevant books. I have to admit that a lot of the books I've been reading lately are more in the vein of sort of the psychology or mental aspects of environmental work, or just books that are kind of celebrating aspects of the natural world. For me, I find that those kind of balance out the day-to-day academic articles and focus on climate change. So I'll mention a few of those. I just finished reading a book called The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. It's by Paul Loeb. It's not explicitly focused on environmental issues, but it does feature them quite prominently. And it's a book that's a collection of stories and essays focusing on people and movements in the past, specifically in situations where people have faced seemingly impossible or very difficult odds, and sort of how they find hope and strength and persist through them. For me, I think it just holds really valuable lessons for people like myself working on kind of existentially scary topics sometimes, but also relevant for non-environmental social movements. And I tend to just find that looking back into history to find examples of people who have faced kind of existential odds or really intense, challenging problems can be really useful. I've loved that book. Highly recommend.
That sounds so interesting. And I just... I just searched for it really quick, and apparently that title, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, is borrowed from a Billie Holiday lyric.
Really? I've actually been wondering. All right. Now that's I learned something. I believe you.
Hopefully the internet is right.
Yeah. So that's a great book. I guess I have two more maybe. Up next, I am hoping to read Hannah Ritchie's Not the End of the World. I guess there's a bit of an optimism or persistence theme here. I can't say much about that book because I just started it, but I've heard great things. And I also really enjoyed her recent TED Talk. It's about a 15-minute TED Talk, but I really enjoyed it and motivated me to read the book. And then I guess one more that I'm actually just staring at on my desk is a book called The High Sierra, A Love Story. It's by Stanley Robinson, who's the author of The Ministry for the Future. So that's a kind of popular book right now folks might have heard of in the environmental and climate theme. But this book is just this very kind of raw, beautifully written book about the California Sierra Nevada mountains. And it traces the author's exploration of them and his just adoration of these mountains throughout his life. It's been fun for me because I grew up in California. It really does kind of read like a love story, and it makes you want to just drop everything and go hiking. Which is frustrating at times, but also fun. And I don't know, I've found that it's sort of this nice reminder of these parts of the natural world that we kind of grow our identities around and are really tied to, that can be really needed escapes from work, but simultaneously really strong motivators for our work, which I guess kind of comes back to growing up in nature and in California and something that motivates me and also provides a lot of relief. So I think that is a great book that I highly recommend. It has some really beautiful photographs as well.
That sounds lovely. Yeah, we actually interviewed Kim Stanley Robinson on the show about 2 years ago, I think, shortly after Ministry for the Future came out.
Oh, I'll have to listen to that one.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to read his newer work. Well, Lisa Reynolds, one more time, thank you so much for coming out to the show and helping us understand HFCs, their social costs, and how policy can help reduce them. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Resources Radio, a podcast from Resources for the Future, or RFF. If you have a minute, we'd really appreciate you leaving us a rating or a comment on your podcast platform of choice. Also, feel free to send us your suggestions for future episodes. This podcast is made possible with the generous financial support of our listeners. You can help us continue producing these kinds of discussions on the topics that you care about by making a donation to Resources for the Future online at rff.org/donate. RFF is an independent, nonprofit research institution in Washington, D.C. Our mission is to improve environmental, energy, and natural resource decisions through impartial economic research and policy engagement. The views expressed on this podcast are solely those of the podcast guests and may differ from those of RFF experts, its officers, or its directors. RFF does not take positions on specific legislative proposals. Resources Radio is produced by Elizabeth Wasson, with music by me, Daniel Raby. Join us next week for another episode.